When was the last time you refreshed your bedding? Sleep cooler with Avocado's naturally breathable, certified organic sheets. Choose from GOTS-certified organic cotton, linen, or hemp, all made-safe certified to the highest standards of non-toxic safety, delivering the ultimate in luxury, sustainability, and style, and a deeper, more restorative sleep. Join Avocado's mission to be one of the world's most sustainable brands at avocadomattress.com.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 16th through the 26th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your bedroom, living room, or home office, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Dynamite from the post-rest inside. AEW lighting up the fuse. Sit back and enjoy the bubbly. As we hear from John and Waitay, where we're going, we don't need roads. And if the buck stops here, yeah, this thing might blow. Everything you hear, opinions of the show. And if you don't like it, go to the forums and let them know.
Still a good theme song. I do like this one quite a bit.
It has really stood the test of time. I think all of our theme songs have.
This one's kind of, it's aged gracefully, you know, like where we're going, we don't need roads. I mean, that definitely turned out to be apropos.
100%, yeah. I don't know if we're even in a space to update it, because I don't know if I've had contact with Jacob Chestnut in quite some time. So.
I never thought that was his real name, but let's assume it is.
Yeah,
Jacob, we appreciate your contributions.
Oh, 100%, yeah.
All these years later. Can you believe that we're coming up on 6 years of Dynamite this fall?
I can, because there's, in fact, a book coming out talking about the first five.
That's right. There is that coming out, yes. This book is all Elite.
Yeah.
It's really setting the bar high. Like, you can't come out with a subpar book if you're claiming. Like, it's like, this book is amazing, is like what you're saying.
I mean, the promotion has, I guess, set a pretty high bar by naming the promotion that.
How deep are you into All the President's Men in advance of next week's book club, Wei?
I might have to start tonight before I listen to book club tomorrow.
You know what I have found?
Oh, sorry, next week.
Next week, Wei. Yes, week, yeah. I know that's what you meant. With this book club going on, I found myself, I was reading three books at once.
Wow. Yeah, uh-huh. And that's at the really same time, you just like got three things open and you're reading.
Not simultaneously, but I have three books on the go, and it's stressful because I'm like, I don't like having these multiple books. I like to go in sequential order. So I was really proud of myself. I finished one yesterday. I finished another today. So I'm down to one book. I feel in a great mood because of this. I feel like I just, took off like a backpack of rocks that I've been walking around with all this excess.
Well, that's nice. You have a feeling of accomplishment. I mean, it's self-imposed stress, but that's
the best kind.
That relief that comes off of it is would you say worthwhile?
Yeah.
Will you do it again?
I'm gonna have to, because I think it's I left this Woodward Bernstein one to the last minute, but I finished it yesterday. So.
Are you at all afraid that, like, you know, because reading for John is your relaxation. Are you at all worried that it could turn into, like, homework or more?
Sometimes it is homework.
Yeah.
But some are not. No, I genuinely enjoy reading.
All right. Great.
But I also challenge myself. So I do, I impose a frantic nature to me as well.
Book Club is out for our double and espresso patrons. Next week, John Pollock and Neil Flanagan chatting about All the President's Men.
All of them. Every single last one. But Thursday, i.e. tomorrow, Rewind Away number 182 is dropping. And Wei, what is on the menu for Thursday?
We are going back to 2003, 22 years ago, everybody, to chat about Brock Lesnar versus Kurt Angle, a very, very well-remembered 60-minute Iron Man matchup that these two had on an edition of SmackDown, the first time that the WWE has ever done a 60-minute Iron Man match on television. So we will be talking about the match, a match that Kurt Angle discusses very fondly. We will be discussing, I think, the unique idea of doing a televised 60-man Iron Man match, how the match performed on the quarter, in the ratings patterns on television at the time. And, of course, we're talking about the whole edition of SmackDown, which will not just feature these two, but for the first half, a real who's who of 2003-era SmackDown, including Los Guerreros. We will be talking about Rey Mysterio, Tajiri. We will be talking about Shaniqua and her lovely gimmick as the dominatrix for the Basham brothers.
High art in 2003.
Yeah, a lot of fun stuff.
We're going to talk about Saddam Hussein's kids.
John Cena with, I would say, by today's standards, a pretty shocking rap about John Ritter.
Yes. Yeah, John Ritter, who had died like just days before this rap. How would John Cena pay tribute?
Yeah, yeah.
Tune in forward to it for Rewind Away. That's coming out on Thursday. Also want to give notice that we have released the story of Sabu, where I have gone through the entire career of one Terrence Brunk, and that is now up for everybody at postwrestling.com, along with an audio version. And thanks to the great Wei Ting, it's also on YouTube. Look at this graphic. I'm not pulling this off. Only waiting.
Well, you supply the words, and boy, did you supply the words, John. Incredible work. I know you poured a lot of hours into this, and it certainly shows. Every time something like this happens, whether it be an unfortunate event or just anything that, you know, you decide to like invest your time into, it always turns out to be incredibly comprehensive and well worth people's time. So I encourage people to check it out. 24-minute podcast, or read the article.
And the final thing I will mention, today's Pollock and Thurston, we went through a lot of interesting topics, including, this was the headliner just for Wei Ting, Mark Shapiro speaking at the JP Morgan conference. And we went through a whole variety of sound bites from Mark Shapiro talking about their live event strategy, the fact that they set their cost savings for $100 million, and they blew past that figure. He was so happy about that. We aired a lot of clips on the show, Wei, but I did save one just for you. This is our moment of zen here with Mark Shapiro.
Netflix itself is a transformative deal, as I said, $5.2 billion over 10 years. They have over 300 million subscribers. This is the last time they will publicly, you know, announce their subscriber count, or at least for now. But yep. You know, there's been plenty of articles and following with regard to their internal forecast, where they're trying to get over 400 million subscribers and maybe the first $1 trillion valuation. I like the sound of that.
Sorry, you had to wait a little, and I don't know if the payoff is quite there, but I feel that was a good Mark Shapiro.
Any sort of emotion coming out of Mark Shapiro, I think is well worth my time. And we know what makes this man happy. You know, the sound of a $1 trillion valuation.
I like that.
Yeah. the promise.
What I would just say is, if you know our management team, we don't sit still. There will always be a lot of gas in this car. Call it rocket fuel.
Uh-huh.
That's all.
Right. I didn't know that about Netflix, that they were no longer going to announce their
Yeah, they've stopped, because it's like the theory is...
Like plateauing? Is that what we're reading into?
I mean, it's a strategic one in that they felt like they've squeezed as much as they can out of eliminating the password sharing, and knew that they got a bump from that. They've, you know, there's still some areas of the world that they can expand to, but there's such a focus on the growth every quarter that, I mean, they can really just trumpet their
revenue. We're basically only going to hear news whenever it's good news for them.
I mean, in a nutshell, yes. I mean, if they hit 400 million, guess what? I think they'll break their rule and let us know about it. So On to Dynamite we are heading, and it is Beach Break from the Now Arena in Hoffman Estates. WrestleTick's final number that they put out today, 4,817 tickets distributed. Not only would that be their largest TV attendance of the year, it's their highest TV attendance since Grand Slam last September. So, and this tops their last highest number of the year, which was 2 weeks ago, I think, in Norfolk, Virginia, where they did about 3,900. So, I mean, again, these... To me, that would be a very encouraging sign that this was seen as a show that felt important, and the cage match was, you know, something that they built up for weeks, and it seemed, especially over this last week, that they were able to, you know, for AEW to get just south of 5,000 for a TV taping is very good for AEW.
And maybe encouraging for that upcoming Chicago residency to see that there's still quite the demand in the city.
We have Ian Riccaboni, Excalibur, and Taz on commentary. And coming back, it wasn't just a one-off. We've got Sum 41, which looks to be, you know, it's the new wallpaper of the show.
Yeah, I don't see maybe nearly the debate going on about the song as there might have been for I'm So Excited. So
We got another debate on tonight's show about a theme.
Apparently so, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. with a very...
are very sensitive about the wrestling music.
Very, very much so. Yeah. Will Ospreay and Hangman Page taking on Konosuke Takeshita and Josh Alexander in the opening. Don Callis sits down. Ian asks, what are you doing here? And Callis explains, I've been sitting on commentary for the last 5 years calling my guys matches. That's what I'm doing here. So Page receives the tag after Ospreay is beaten down. He goes wild on Alexander with a Death Valley driver, then a pop-up sit-out powerbomb onto Takeshita for a two count. And we're seeing reluctance on the part of Ospreay and Hangman to want to tag the other in. They're getting along, but not that well. Then we go to the commercial break, and this is when a hammerlock is applied by Josh Alexander, and Taz compliments him on his S-grip, and Don Callis says, Taz, would you call that a key lock? No, Don, I wouldn't, because it's not. And I just found this to be a great, great interplay between these two. Ospreay and Page get on the same page with a Orihara Sky Twister press combo off the turnbuckles to the floor. Ospreay's handspring gets caught by Alexander, and he's sent off the shoulders with a unidentified flying Ospreay. Ospreay then takes a bunch of suplexes and is placed onto the shoulders of Takeshita. Poison Rana hits Oscutters to both. And then as Page calls for the hidden blade, Ospreay calls for the hidden blade, Hangman tags himself in. Ospreay's not happy with this. Josh ducks, and Hangman nearly takes out his partner with the buckshot. Then they get into a shoving match. Josh ducks the hidden blade, and this time Ospreay pulls up from hitting his partner, and they end up working together for this, the buckshot blade combination for the win, with Page pinning Josh in 18 minutes and 34 seconds. And Page and Ospreay eventually come to blows here, and Takeshita jumps him. Alexander joins in, and then Bryce has to get between Page and Ospreay. So this was like your, can your partners get along? But I really thought they did like a good job of, hey, we want to win this match, but it left you with enough that you're really looking forward to this match at the end, that these two are, you know, it's like they're both after this big tournament win. And I like this overall. This was a very strong opener.
This match felt like it was designed, being very aware that it was going to play into what is at this point a very tired trope of, you know, two people about to face each other, asking the question of whether or not they could get along. And because of that, I thought it did enough to justify it and to make it not necessarily just a cliched match that we've seen before. I would say maybe the biggest difference, though, between this and like most can they get along types of matches, it's just really the quality of the wrestling. I mean, surprise, surprise. Look at like this. Look at these four in a ring together. You know, you're going to get something exceptional, both in terms of just technique, in terms of just like even high flying here, and certainly in the case of creativity. And that even comes in a lot of the storytelling spots that they were doing to try to answer the question whether or not these two get along. I really like, you know, like much like the Kenny and Ospreay pairing, I thought like seeing Paige and Ospreay together here felt like another superhero team up, in that you kind of got something very special by seeing these two being on the same side rather than just like two singles performers like tagging in and out. And that came in, I think, the creativity they employed in those very well timed near miss friendly fire spots, like just inches away from, you know, actually making contact with each other, both with the buckshot and also the hidden blade. And then just this like very simple but very great finish with the both of them hitting those two moves at the same time. That was just like, again, very much like a superhero team up, you know. I also really like the team of Takeshita and Alexander together. I mean, I think it feels to me like they complement each other's styles well. I don't think one overshadows another, and I think that says a lot about how well Josh Alexander is being integrated into the company right now. He's not necessarily somebody that, like, you know, it was like a top name, not somebody who's even like, you know, talking a whole lot, but where he is shining is his, they're giving him in ring time to showcase his craft, and they're putting him in there with high level talent, and he's showing that he belongs in this mix with the Takeshita, with an Ospreay, with the Page. So I think that he's actually doing really well. He, along with Speedball and with Kevin Knight, like three recent debuts that are,
they've all come in with a plan. They've been put in very good positions, like not top of the bill, but they are in positions where you take them all seriously. Mm-hmm. And as well, it's, they're having regular appearances on television. Like, they're figured in. I agree with you, like in a tag division that did not have this Hurt Syndicate angle, I think these guys would be tremendous with those belts. And that could be something they play out down the road.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Going to the gym can be discouraging, especially if you're putting in the work but barely seeing changes. But with Tonal, you can actually see your progress with every workout. Tonal provides the convenience of a full gym and the expertise of a personal trainer anytime at home with one sleek system. Designed to reduce your mental load, Tonal is the ultimate strength training system, helping you focus less on workout planning and more on getting results. No more second-guessing your technique. Tonal gives you real-time coaching cues to dial in your form and help you lift safely and effectively. After a quick assessment, Tonal sets the optimal weight for every move and adjusts in 1-pound increments as you get stronger, so you're always challenged. Tonal lets you choose from a variety of expert-led workouts, from strength to arrow hit to yoga and mobility, to keep you coming back for more. For a limited time, go to Tonal.com to get $500 off your Tonal purchase, plus a free 4-year warranty. That's Tonal.com for $500 off, plus a free 4-year warranty. Tonal.com.
This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we're bringing you three editions of Rewind Away, including an in-depth look at WrestleMania 32 from 2016, a 2003 edition of SmackDown featuring the Iron Man match between Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar, and a special patron's pick where you get to choose what John and Wei review. MCU Later returns with a review of Thunderbolts. Pollock and Tin will sit down and talk. We've also got coverage of Wrestling Dontaku, Collision Course every Saturday night, and of course, XL editions of Rewind, a Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. $6 a month gets you in the door at postwrestlingcafe.com. Samoa Joe and John Moxley preview, where they go through all the casualties of this war. Alicia Toot is with Top Flight, reacting to their just destruction last week at the hands of MJF. So Dante cuts a spirited promo threatening to bite off MJF's nose, and they want the tag belts. Dustin Rhodes and Sammy Guevara overhear this, and Dustin likes what they're saying and says, "You're the underdogs. Prove them wrong. We'll be watching."
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we will be watching Top Flight. But first, it is Ricochet, accompanied by a prosthetic leg, to the ring, taking on Zach Gowen, who must only have possession of one prosthetic leg because he had to resort to crutches to come down to the ring. This must have been a hell of a week for Zach Gowen after Ricochet stole his leg.
I guess I wonder what like, is it how many prosthetic legs would somebody actually have. I can't imagine these things.
You always have to be prepared that someone could rip one off and take it.
You always have a backup.
You always have a backup. It's like a tire in your back seat.
Yeah, with him, I would assume so. But I would also imagine that like I can see him most of the time not even using the prosthetic leg and just getting along fine.
Well, his family is in the front row, and Gowan is doing like this low stance to try and shoot on Ricochet, and Ricochet, like, this was like a cool start to the match, and Ricochet like cannot figure this out and ends up being chased to the floor.
It's been quite a while since I've, other than this past weekend, but it's been a while since I've watched SmackDown from 2003. But like, did Gowan employ this sort of like low level, you know, grounded style in the past?
I'm sure he has. I am not up on all my most recent Zach Gowan offense, but
it's logical. If you only have three legs, you use your arms like they're legs, and you know.
Oh, he has one leg. He doesn't have three.
Okay, well, I meant like you're right. Yeah,
three limbs. Yes,
three limbs. Like you. Anyway, it was really cool to see like how somebody if this was real, how would they strategically use only having one leg as a bit of an advantage.
Gowan connects with a pescado, but then Ricochet is able to take over and puts Gowan onto his back. And for the comedy, he goes for a figure four and reaching for the non-existent leg. He then gets caught with a small package. So Ricochet is done playing around. He hits a springboard 450. Gowan kicks out. He hits a shooting star off the top. Gowan kicks out again, and Ricochet can't believe it. So then he goes and hits vertigo, and Gowan kicks out. And at this point, like, the crowd is like getting impressed here. Ricochet goes for the scissors, and Rick Knox stops him from using the scissors.
Not a wrestling move. He grabs the gold scissors.
Yeah. The gold scissors. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Not a head scissors. And as Rick Knox turns his back, Gowan hits him with the prosthetic leg for the big near fall of the match, and Ricochet kicks out. Gowan goes for the moonsault off the top, misses, and is left to be hit by the spirit gun as Ricochet wins in 7 minutes and 22 seconds. Afterwards, hits him with another spirit gun, and dude does the Randy Orton punt to his head. And then Mark Briscoe runs down as they explain their history in Ring of Honor together, Gowan and Briscoe. Ricochet gave him a ton here, and for pretty much like a 1 week build for a match that like I do not see Zach Gowan having much beyond this. I guess you could do something with him and Mark Briscoe, but like they just gave him a lot here. This was the right finish for it, and it was like, let's give people one convincing near fall spot, and I think they got there with the prosthetic leg.
Did you have issue that they gave Gowan so much offense?
No, I didn't at I all. Didn't like that should be Ricochet's role here. Was like he threw everything. A lot of people like would not have given him as much, and I thought it made for a much more entertaining match for the fact that they gave Gowan a chance here.
Yeah. Like I only ask that because I'm trying to vocalize in my mind why I was perfectly fine seeing like a pretty 50-50. I want to say maybe 60-40 match here when I really enjoyed maybe the 80-20 of a Pat McAfee versus Gunther. And I think the dynamics are very different, not to mention the fact that I think audience expectations can be very different when you're watching a WWE versus watching AEW, where I think there's a lot more precedent put on in-ring quality. And when I'm watching a Zach Gowan, I want to see Zach Gowan do his cool shit. And
Ricochet as opposed to like if this were Samoa Gunther. Joe, you're structuring probably a different type of match.
Yeah. Like as far as these sort of special attraction matches go, you know, like I'm really enjoying them lately. Like these sort of surprises, not knowing who you're going to get, you know, that particular week. Like, you know, whether it be a Rhino or in this case, a pull from like out of nowhere in a Zach Gowan. This match offered something that obviously was very different from any other match you would see both on the show and also throughout Ricochet's heel run. Gowan, I felt all these years later, like still looked very impressive. His spots look great. Built to a really nice near fall here with that prosthetic leg. But the thing that continues to stand out to me in these matches is the great heel work from Ricochet, who was doing so well antagonizing both this crowd and Gowan's family to the point where like he's just commanding the energy in this room in a way that we really have never seen him do, you know, throughout his career prior. So really great heat for Ricochet and just a thoroughly entertaining match, in my opinion.
Could you see Gowan and Briscoe maybe like teaming up on like a Zero Hour or something like that? I really don't want to see Ricochet, mainly because I don't think Ricochet should have, you know, people that he's teaming with. I mean, outside of the Bucks, I don't think it really like
fits. I like the Bucks team plenty. Like, I like him as a replacement for Jack Perry in the Elite. But I kind of like him even on his own, honestly.
I do too. And that feels like a Zero Hour level like pairing for Briscoe and Gowan. The fact that they had Briscoe come out here suggests like maybe they do something of note with Gowan beyond just tonight. But for a 1 week buildup, I thought this really worked for especially for Ricochet being the one. He was the perfect opponent. Renee interviews MJF and he states that you know, we have a stacked roster. I only like to wrestle when I win, and if I join the Hurt Syndicate, we'll be unstoppable, and it'll only be a matter of if, of when, not if, I win the title again. And Renee asks him, have you thought about what the Hurt Syndicate might do to you if they say no to you tonight? And he's got this fear of, what if I'm being led to slaughter here? And the Hurt Syndicate walk in and tell him it's imperative that he appear in the ring after our tag match, and MJF is very worried. Lashley and Shelton Benjamin against Top Flight in our Eliminator bout. And so Top Flight come out looking for revenge. And Lashley catches Dante on the floor. And then it's a Tope Suicida from Darius. And they're trying to double team. Benjamin comes in, hits the Germans to Darius, and then a step up knee. And then it's a big spear by Lashley. The crowd is just cheering them. I felt terrible for Top Flight here. They're just like, the babyface is coming for revenge, and it's like the crowd is totally behind the bullies. And the Hurt Lock is applied to Dante. Shelton just kills Darius with a super kick, so he can't save, and Dante goes out. 4 minutes and 26 seconds as Rhodes and Guevara are out because Lashley won't release the Hurt Lock, and we get Dustin Rhodes cutting a promo saying that, Bobby, you look like an asshole in there. Why don't you pick on someone your own size? MVP respects Dustin. I respected your father, so I'm not going to send my guys out on you. Dustin says, listen, it's obvious what we're looking for. And before they can ask for the tag title shot, Crew come out. Leo Rush and Action Andretti. And they threaten to rearrange Guevara's face and send him home to his daughter while making fun of Dustin's age. And Rush mentions old business with the Hurt Syndicate and says, based on our history, Bobby, we want a tag title shot. And Dustin says, you're not going to cut the line, you stupid son of a bitch. And our matchmaker MVP proposes that they have a match on Collision to determine who gets the tag title shot at Double or Nothing. Amazing how all of this worked out.
I was very excited in the hopes that Leo was going to ask Bobby to hit him with the pose. just for all that wonderful nostalgia. I can't believe that was a thing. Can you imagine like seeing the talent of these two? And hey, coming up with that
bend
creative?
Over and show off your ass.
Holy shit. Anyway, they are making reference to that history, you know, assuming that everybody remembers it, which how could we forget, right? So, you know, pretty easy setup here for the Hurt Syndicate's opponents at the pay-per-view. I'm sure they will dominate whoever should be there. And because I'm sensing maybe a bit more attention being put into the Sons of Texas long term, I could see Crew winning this one to for the Hurt Syndicate to beat up at the pay-per-view. I could see Dustin and Sammy getting the all-in spot in Texas.
That's possible, yeah. It's a real tough one just visually of like the Hurt Syndicate as the baby faces against Crew. Yeah. But you're going to run into that.
Yeah. It's a tough visual to think of the Hurt Syndicate as anything but baby faces. But both of these are, well, you know what?
They're very situational, and I think they lean more babyface in most of these. Yeah. It's just, it's unfortunate when you have like a Top Flight and it's just like, you know, where the audience is like, they want to cheer on like the dominant monsters, and that's what they were here. So Top Flight has not come out of these 2 weeks all that great.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I say all this without remembering that they are working a program here potentially with MJF, and that could also be culminating at All In, or it could just simply progress through All In.
MJF music plays, but he doesn't come out. So MVP sends Shelton to go find him, and he's hiding in the gorilla area by Tony Khan and Jerry Lynn and gets brought out. And MVP and Shelton, they put their thumbs up and it's down to Lashley, and he puts his arm around MJF, and he's doing the tease, the thumbs going up, the thumbs going down. And meanwhile, Shelton is preparing for a super kick. And you're watching this, and the idea was they're gonna kill this guy. But Lashley puts the thumb up, and MJF is stunned, and he starts celebrating, and he's yelling, "We hurt people." And next week will be the official contract signing for MJF to join the Hurt Syndicate. But the way this was left, though, like they're certainly leaving you with the idea that Lashley and Shelton are at least still plotting here, and leaving that as if MJF is walking into his demise.
Yes, though by the end of the show, I think you're also left wondering if MJF is plotting. I mean, I think we're supposed to be feeling that.
We're doing spy versus spy.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we know that this association will not last. Who will be the first to screw the other? And who is really kind of like thinking...
This is basically our MJF Adam Cole feud, but for some reason I find this one to be a little more intriguing.
You know, because, like, I guess Cole is that sort of character, but I think, like, MVP with the Hurt Syndicate, it feels like he's a better version of that sort of, like, you know, like three steps ahead type of villain. I think they've done such a great job with this story so far. I've been very impressed with how simple the storytelling has been, just with the, you know, motif of the thumbs up, thumbs down, and how much time they've gotten out of this without feeling tired. And maybe some people might disagree with that and feel that, hey, like, this has kind of been too long. I don't. Like, I feel like it's progressed at a great pace, and they managed to garner pretty strong reactions, I would say, every single week. So it's only starting. I'm looking forward to seeing how the rest of what they've mapped out plays out.
Does this all in the end tie together, and it's MJF on the outs with the Hurt Syndicate when it's revealed the real new member of the Hurt Syndicate is Jeff Jarrett? Remember that program? Remember that?
They seem to have dropped that completely cold.
Boy, did that go nowhere.
Like, do we even know if is this still Jarrett's last year, or at least like his stipulated one? Like,
so he showed up
contract?
On Collision a few weeks ago,
yeah,
and he's blamed Sanjay Dutt for him not being on TV.
Okay,
Sanjay.
And by the way, is Sanjay in canon? Is Sanjay a producer with an executive in AEW?
Well, he was in this backstage scene where he was seated with Jerry Lynn and Tony Khan, so. Yeah, I don't know.
So he's blaming Sanjay for not booking him or not helping him get booked?
That was kind of how it was. And then Jay Lethal was now taking the reins on this thing. This Jarrett thing, it started promising, and it's just totally spiraled into nothing.
I think they might be Tony just like reading the audience reaction to some of those MJF segments and not and responding. You know, like Jarrett going for a mid-tier title, I could buy much more than...
No one needs to see him going for the title. I was definitely surprised that the Owen just came and went, and like not anything with Jarrett. Not even like you just got nothing out of it.
Not even a qualifier.
Nothing. Like, he didn't have to go far in it, but just not include him at all. It just feels as though they just dropped things cold.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chopped-tees.com/post-wrestling.
Next eliminator, it's Timeless, Tony Storm, Sky Blue, Azumi, and Mina Shirakawa, and they showed highlights of Azumi's strong women's title win on Friday at Resurgence, where it was not Mercedes Moné taking the fall, but rather Mina Shirakawa, so more to come on that. And Tony Storm, 12-0 in eliminators going into this match, and Mina Shirakawa, this was her first official match under an AEW exclusive contract, and she comes out, and someone decided... You know what Mina Shirakawa really needs? A new theme song. And she came out to something that I can only imagine was her audition theme if she had gone to WWE. And she comes out and she's dancing to this. And then
I was going to say, like, did you follow the online reaction?
Yes.
I kind of stayed out of it. What exactly? How did
people were furious about this and apparently were tagging Tony Khan. So if you go back, we can skip to the end here. When Mina wins, Tony made the decision midway through from all of the complaints to go back to her old theme, which is what he played at the end of the match.
That's crazy.
So this will be one of the shortest used themes ever. I don't know why you would change it. Mina had a great theme.
I can understand if they didn't have full rights, like, or full ownership of the theme song.
They played it at the end of this, so I'm sure
that it's... through a partnership. Like, I mean, I don't know what... Like, Tony can own any song, clearly.
This
like,
guy's bought Metallica. I mean, this guy, he can manage to get Stardom track 37A.
But if you could... like own 100% of a song, like I can understand that decision. I can also understand wanting to re-debut somebody with a bit of a fresh presentation, and that might come in the form of a song. But at this point, I think the song is so tied to Mina in her entrance that maybe they didn't expect the audience to react this, you know, passionately, but they did.
I'd spend $100 and I'd say, hey, Mikey Ruckus, here's an accordion I just bought for you. Go make something. And this is the new,
you know, the audience would respond pretty poorly. It's not just the accordion, but like probably every single note that I think they need. Don't fuck with their music.
Yeah. Well, dude, this crowd, this online crowd,
tell you something that Tony is like, this responsive to like something that's like a crowd response that is taking place at the moment? Should a promoter be like this actively sort of following Twitter?
I think it puts him in a very positive light for a move like this. Like, yeah, certainly you don't want you don't need to be online nonstop. But like, look at this. Like, to me, this is someone that listens to his audience and gave them what they wanted at the end of this. So I thought this was like, you're not going to get that kind of a reaction too often. So Mina's out, and then we have Sky Blue in her first match since July here in her hometown of Chicago. She definitely had some hiccups in this match. You know, in
of the four, she was clearly number four. Yes,
You know, you're coming back after 10 months. It's, you know, a really, really bad ankle injury. It's a four way on top of that, and it's just, you know, she had several spots that were off. You could see and probably attribute to the time away or just like not having that smoothness.
But the crowd greatly helped her, obviously, in Chicago.
I thought, given it was Chicago, I thought there was a decent chance she was going to win this to get the title match, but probably making the right choice here. So Shirakawa and Izumi started at the beginning. They went at this crazy pace to begin, and they took turns with everyone delivering vertical suplexes. Then we got like stereo Germans with Storm and Izumi. So it comes down to Storm and Izumi, and Storm hits one to Izumi and then goes for hip attacks into all three corners. The Code Blue is attempted by Sky Blue to Mina and just does not hit it. It just basically turns into a sunset roll up. Then she tries one to Izumi. Izumi avoids it and hits her with a destroyer. And then we have the Storm Zero onto Izumi. Mina makes the save, and it's Mina with a pair of elbow strikes towards Storm, who then ducks the last one, applies the big package. Mina reverses and catches Toni Storm, beating her in an eliminator bout in 12 minutes and 11 seconds. And boom, the graphic shows up, Double or Nothing. No contract signing necessary. That's how much demand there was for this match. And Mina's new music / old music is playing, and this will be a rematch from last year's Forbidden Door.
She won the match, and she won her old music back. That's how big of a
huge
win this was.
Huge stakes for Mina Shirakawa here in her return to AEW.
Yeah, I thought the match was great, you know, and I think so much of it is also really admiring the path they've taken us to get to this point. You know, we knew this Toni Storm undefeated streak in these title eliminators would end at some point, but I personally didn't necessarily expect it to end tonight, and maybe I should have, just because if
you needed to create a challenger, and
if it's going to end with anybody, it should be on somebody at the level of Mina Shirakawa, who comes in and you could, you know, even just put her into a pay-per-view match without much justification. But the fact that they did all of this to give her what felt more than just a big win, I thought was a great way to reintroduce Mina Shirakawa and to tell the story to lead up to this title match. I thought everybody like had a chance to shine, but it was Mina to me that shone the most. Her return was met with great response, and she looked very aggressive in the ring, very impressive.
I thought also, Izumi looked very good in this match. I was glad that they included her in it. And obviously, it was not just like, okay, she was here in California, we'll book her in the match. Like, they're doing this angle now with Mercedes. So Izumi is being helped to the back, and Mercedes runs out and attacks her, applies the statement maker, and then Jamie Hayter comes out to break it up. And she puts Mercedes in the statement maker, and like none of the announcers sell this, that she's putting her in her own move, and security comes out before she can hit the Haterade. So I would think we're probably getting Mercedes and Izumi, and Mercedes is getting her belt back at Double or Nothing.
Mercedes Izumi, and Mercedes wins the
strong women's title.
Yes, yes, yes. Now, does that mean Mercedes does not win the Owen? Or does it have any?
Oh, sorry, sorry. I'm totally blanking here. Yeah, she's in the Owen, so that makes no sense. But we're obviously getting a match with Izumi and Mercedes at some point.
Yeah, yeah. I was also really impressed with the coordination here between all of these like characters that have taken here, and how well this match integrates with the New Japan Strong match that just took place in another promotion over the weekend. I mean, having Shirakawa take the pin in that match was immediately nullified by having Shirakawa win here, you know, beating Izumi and earning herself, you can argue, bigger opportunities, you know, by challenging Storm. And then the way that this played off into the, you know, continuation of the Banks versus Izumi program to lead into Forbidden Door, I just felt all of this was just like wonderfully coordinated between AEW and New Japan.
Yeah, because this is a match, I guess you could do it on any of these big shows that are coming up in the next one. Like, that's the one thing of all those shows we went through in June. Like, they're going to have to put a lot of big matches on TV in June. Like, that 4-hour special, like, Jesus, that's going to be, and then you got Arena Mexico. There's no shortage of slots to fill in June.
Forbidden Door feels pretty far away. I don't know if they can hold off, like, all the way till end of August.
Yeah, that's the end of August. I don't think they're holding off on that one. Then we had it was very simple, but a very classy tribute for Sabu as they played his music in the arena. They showed a video, and then, you know, really like the, if you're going to call it the highlight of this segment, it was Taz just totally choked up, sharing words for Sabu, saying that he always brought the best out of me, and everyone just pointed to the sky. It was just a really nice tribute for Sabu.
For a company that doesn't have any footage to use, I guess, of Sabu. Well, they did have
they do have that one match. They do. When he was in Adam Cole's corner.
How could I forget? Well, I don't know if that would have been the best representation.
They didn't show any of that in the video, like not even like walk into the ring or anything. I don't believe.
Maybe it was fine, but like I think for the lack of, I guess, like, you know, actual video footage that they could have used, having this sort of like very heartfelt speech from Taz, in a rare case of Taz taking off his sunglasses and getting emotional, I thought kind of was a very classy way of paying tribute.
Renee is with MVP and MJF, and MJF says he just needs his lawyer, Mark Sterling, to go over the contract. MVP is questioning why he needs a lawyer to look over the contract, but Sterling walks in, MVP will not shake his hand, and MJF says that, wouldn't you want a lawyer to look over a contract? And MVP understands, and they walk off together. But yes, looks like aligning Mark Sterling here with MJF.
I mean, I think unofficially, or maybe officially, he's always been this is not the first time he's used him as a lawyer. I guess
he's had no legal issues over the last few years because these two have not been on camera together in a long time.
I'm liking the direction of this. You know, like, we thought MVP and the Hurt Syndicate held all the cards, but it's clear there's something that MJF might be working on in the background. So we'll see. We'll see what sort of clauses Sterling might introduce into maybe we get an amendment to the contract.
An addendum.
Addendum. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Shivani is with Nigel McGuinness in the ring, and Nigel apologizes for getting into the ring on Collision when he isn't an announcer. He says he apologizes to Tony. He also needs to apologize to Daniel Garcia. So Garcia comes out. Nigel explains, I let my ego get in the way. I ruined your match. My place is at the desk. I promise this won't happen again. Garcia says, you can keep your apology because you did exactly what you should have done. You stood up for yourself. FTR tried to end your career. They tried to end Copeland's career, and they'll try to do the same to you, referring to Nigel. They tried to end Garcia's career. He says, I'm going to fight FTR with or without you, Nigel, but it would be my honor to have you at my side. And before Nigel can answer, out comes Big Stoke. And Hathaway says that FTR is not here tonight, which was a signal that they were. And what Nigel did was egregious, and mentions Dax having a separated shoulder after Saturday. Nigel sarcastically apologizes, but Hathaway says there are consequences, and your punishment is getting in the ring with the best team alive, FTR, where they can't be fined or suspended for what they're going to do to you. Nigel agrees. Yeah, they will kill us. And that's it. He just tells Garcia, like, we'd be like top flight in this equation. And he says, Garcia gives a passionate promo that you and I have always overcome the odds in our career. Meanwhile, Hathaway calls Nigel the Al Bundy of AEW, reliving your glory days on commentary. He says, how can you expect to beat FTR when you barely beat Hepatitis? And FTR then jump the ring and attack them. And Nigel gets hit with a closed fist, and they go for the spike pile driver when Daddy Magic runs in with a crowbar, and Dax and Cash bail out of the ring. And we have these fans right at the guardrail with signs that read, F the rest, FTR is the best. Very pro FTR signs. Dax just ripped these signs up to shreds. So it does appear that we are going to get Garcia and Nigel against FTR, and maybe Daddy Magic getting bludgeoned before Double or Nothing. With the crowbar. That's my prediction.
With the crowbar. Okay. Yes. I greatly enjoyed all of this. I mean, I've been enjoying this Nigel saga so far. I think Nigel and Tony's performances have been actually really strong. I don't know if I ever thought to pair Nigel McGuinness with Daniel Garcia. I don't know how many of us like wanted that sort of pairing, but they're doing enough like good work to make me want to see that pairing. And certainly, seeing FTR versus Nigel is an attractive matchup, in my opinion. So I'm enjoying all of this.
Do you see it just as the straight tag? Do you see Daddy Magic or Stokely being involved in this? Or
yes, certainly.
Just straight tag.
I see Stokely and Daddy Magic being involved on the outside, but I see straight up tag team. Yeah.
And then Collision they're taping it tonight to air Saturday with the Steve McMichael tribute, Kyle Fletcher against AR Fox, Megan Bain against Anna Jay, Speedball taking on Blake Christian, Sammy Guevara and Dustin Rhodes against Crew in the number one contenders match, and Big Bill and Brian Keith against the Gates of Agony. It feels like a pretty standard Collision card, except for the Steve McMichael tribute that I think is the real big attraction to this.
No doubt. Yeah. Yeah.
And Ric Flair. Ric Flair will appear on it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's some, attractive like mid-card matches on the show as well.
You'll get some very good wrestling on this show, and I guess you do have some consequences with the number one contenders match for the tag. This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, we're bringing you three editions of Rewind Away, including an in-depth look at WrestleMania 32 from 2016, a 2003 edition of SmackDown featuring the Iron Man match between Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar, and a special patron's pick where you get to choose what John and Wei review. MCU Later returns with a review of Thunderbolts. Pollock and Ting will sit down and talk. We've also got coverage of Wrestling Dontaku, Collision Course every Saturday night, and of course, XL editions of Rewind to Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. $6 a month gets you in the door at postwrestlingcafe.com. But now it is time for the steel cage match. When this graphic came up, man, this place, like, they just cheered. They saw this as a very big match. So out come both, and it's the giant AEW steel cage.
So Moxie, I love their cage.
It's gigantic. And every time I think of like Cody doing a moonsault off of this thing.
Crazy.
Early on, Moxley is using a figure four, but Joe gets out, and Claudio and Yuta arrive through the crowd. They're followed by Hobbs and Willow Nightingale coming down, and then during the commercial break, Moxley gets busted open. You couldn't have a cage match and a John Moxley match together.
Doesn't it feel like it's been a while since we've seen Moxley? Am I mistaken?
probably. I imagine he's bled pretty recently.
You're right.
So he's cut open, and I mean, he was covered pretty quickly here. Moxley is biting Joe, and Joe gets him into the STF, moves to the crossface, and Moxley was really selling this crossface with a lot of desperation. Gets to the rope and then connects with a cutter, and Joe kicks out. Moxley goes to the armbar, then to the bulldog choke, but Joe is able to get out of the choke, and then he is hit with the paradigm shift. Joe kicks out at two, and he gets the coquina clutch. At this point, Claudio starts to climb the fence, and Willow, like, runs into Marina, and that knocks Claudio off balance, and he just, like, falls off the side of this cage. Hobbs, meanwhile, puts Yuta through the timekeeper's table and just stares at him dead, when all of a sudden, this man in a hoodie shows up, and this was not Sean Spears, but rather Gabe Kidd, who slides a briefcase into the cage for Moxley to drill Joe and pin him in 14 minutes and 54 seconds. It's revealed as Gabe Kidd. There's a ton in after the match, but what did you think about the 15 minutes here of the cage match?
You know, I didn't think I would enjoy the match as much as I did. Like, at this point, I really like Jon Moxley. I really like Samoa Joe, and I think they've done a good job with the feud. But there's something about the pairing that, to me, just does not feel as exciting or as fresh as so many of the other things that are taking place on this show. You know, when you've got, like, a Page and an Ospreay and just, like, even, like, what's going on with MJF and the Hurt Syndicate, it feels so much more fresh than, I think, like, whatever's still going on with the Death Riders. But the quality of this cage match, like, was really strong, and I found myself very into it the way I have been with really kind of like any major main event involving these two. It felt violent. It felt like stiff in some of those major chops from Joe. Great meshing of the styles between the two that was both at once like technical and also brutal at the same time. So I actually quite enjoyed the match. The finish, of course, at this point, involving cheating, involving interference, to me is somewhat to be expected with the Death Riders finish. I think at this point they're supposed to be intentionally somewhat flat, but in this case they did give you a surprise reveal of a Forbidden Door, I guess, passy.
Yeah, do you think he participated in the catering backstage at an AEW show in
I forgot all of this for somebody who was so critical about AEW. He definitely has made several appearances this year.
Yeah, I'm sure Chris Charlton was probably very disappointed. So Hobbs goes after Gabe Kidd, but then he turns to catch Claudio from behind, and this allows Gabe to low blow Hobbs, and they double team Hobbs, running him into the steps. Then Claudio and Marina throw Willow into the barricade. At this point, the Young Bucks come out and they extend their hand to Jon Moxley when Kenny Omega arrives. So the crowd's going wild for all these appearances. Kenny runs down the aisle. He hit this amazing flying knee to Wheeler Yuta. This looked tremendous. And then he takes out Claudio. The crowd was super heated here. Then Okada shows up attacking Omega with a shot to the body.
Yeah.
Where he had life-saving surgery.
Yeah, well, it's his sensitive area.
So Matt has come out with the control to control the cage, and he's lowering the cage. They didn't even acknowledge him, but Mike Bailey had come out and fought Okada to the back, which clearly we're going to be doing Okada and Speedball after the Kevin Knight deal last week. So that's probably something that Double or Nothing or one of these shows coming up. So they're taken away. They have Joe and Omega trapped in the cage, and it's like 6-on-2. They hit the EVP trigger onto Samoa Joe and a paradigm shift onto Kenny Omega when Swerve's music plays, and now the place goes crazy. The Bucks are freaking out, and Swerve climbs to the top of this cage, and in the greatest gif for mass consumption, Swerve does a swerve stomp off the top, and all six go down like dominoes when he lands this. And it was spectacular. I thought it was
amazing.
It was amazing and ridiculous at the same time. Yep. They go down, and Matt is furiously raising the cage so they can all hightail it. Swerve gets on the mic, and he calls back to the last time he was in this arena inside of a cage. It was All Out last year with Hangman Page, and said, "I'm back. I fear nothing. I am the fear, and I am the most dangerous man in AEW. And he addresses the heels that we want to cause some anarchy at Double or Nothing, including the women. So we have Swerve, Omega, Hobbs, Joe, and Willow in the ring. So supposedly we would be getting a 5-on-5 with Marina and Willow as part of those. The only question being which five will represent, because
the Death Riders.
You have Moxley, you have the Bucks, you have Gabe Kidd now, you have Claudio. Yuta's probably not in this, I would think. But
yeah, I would be willing to bet that Gabe Kidd, I mean, he's not coming in here for no reason. So I think he's more than a substitute for Pac. I think he's supposed to be like a featured person in this Anarchy in the Arena. I think we can expect the Bucks, you know, just because they are big names and they're also directly tied into this feud with Swerve. So the only question is it going to be Mox? And is Claudio, well, it's going to be Mox, obviously, but the question is if Claudio is going to be in.
Yeah, Claudio, I would think Claudio might be the odd man out here, which was interesting. Like, they did the injury angle with him last week, and they could have just kept him out here, but they did bring him back, and that was after the whole chair angle last week. Yeah. But I thought this was an awesome setup for Anarchy in the Arena. This was a really strong end to the show, and I mean, we're only a week and a half away from Double or Nothing, so time was of the essence to shoot this angle to get this locked in.
This post-match was so awesome, dude. Like, this whole thing felt like an Avengers final battle scene. Just like top stars showing up left and on your left. You know, here's Gabe Kidd like coming through the portal, you know, from New Japan. And then here comes Swerve with the Stormbreaker just like being sent through the portal to save the day. Swerve felt like such a big deal coming here, and that stomp looked incredible. And the promo, not to mention, you know,
I am the fear.
Oh my God.
If that's on a t-shirt by next week.
Oh, he feels like such a top guy, and he has been for quite some time, but just like in this sort of setting, he feels just like such a prime commodity for this entire company, and this entire feud feels really hot. I'm loving all of these teams, and they don't even need so much reason to like befriend each other. They just have to have a common goal and a common enemy, and that seems to be this combination of the Bucks and the Death Riders.
Well, they kind of alluded to like the Bucks being the go-between to enlist Gabe Kidd. Like, that was kind of the inference that they made, and therefore they are of value to Moxley now that you've brought this killer to us. Yeah. And that's how Kidd should be presented, as like this guy that's just totally out of control.
You're rekindling Kidd versus Omega, which could lead ultimately to a rematch at Forbidden Door, for instance.
Yeah. I thought this was a really great Dynamite. Like, yes, you had some very good matches on this show, but I thought like the angles feel like they're really peaking for Double or Nothing. And more importantly, like, you're getting kind of the building blocks for All In that you're seeing. Like, you're getting Okada attacking Omega, and you're seeing where things are kind of getting teed up. So like, I think they're going through a period right now where this is one of the stronger booking periods that AEW has had for quite a while. And that's a 180 from where we were like 6 months ago, where I think that was the largest complaint for people. Yeah. But this really set up Double or Nothing, I thought, really, really well. And it's interesting to look at the contrast that we have of, you know, this extended build for Mania this year, and some of the complaints that it was, you know, too much of a holding pattern, you had too much time to build up. And here was AEW that, you know, going into tonight, we had two matches for Double or Nothing. Like, you had teases of where they were going, but here we are 10 days out, and it feels like that, like, you can map out what this card is, like three quarters of what it's going to be. And, you know, all of it makes sense of where you're going toward. It's just a matter of where some of these big matches are going
to
land.
Yeah. Just to maybe update people on the card so far, of course, for Double or Nothing, we've got the finals of the Owen tournament between the men, Ospreay versus Paige. For the women, Mercedes Moné versus Jamie Hayter. And then we also look like, well, we're going to have a Hurt Syndicate versus either Crew or Sons of Texas for the AEW Tag Team Championship. Timeless Tony Storm versus Mina Shirakawa has been announced. Anarchy in the Arena will take place, the TBD about which members will be officially announced for the match.
We're probably going to get this tag with FTR against Nigel and Garcia. They
could get Speedball Okada.
Speedball and Okada. Like, there you go. Like, that's you know, you're at your
and 10 other matches, I'm sure, by the time the
well, we've got 10 days to go, so that all
but
makes
I
sense.
Like I totally agree with your thoughts, John. Like at this point, it's not just maybe a rare like edition of Dynamite receiving strong critical acclaim. It's the trend, and it's been very consistently high at this level. I think like a number of their stories are firing really strong right now. A lot of their champions are really strong champions right now, between, you know, your tag team title program being a pretty strong one with MJF. The women are doing incredibly well right now with Toni Storm at, you know, just being one of the top stars of the entire company. Mercedes, I think, is a really strong, you know, character right now. Top to bottom, the only continued questionable part is this Death Rider stuff, and that looks to be in pretty good shape for Anarchy in the Arena here.
Yeah, and like really, this beach break show, like again, like we're talking like in relative terms, but like to draw like almost 5,000 people, like that is our first sign of, you know, some it's one show, but it also comes just after Norfolk, where they did, you know, that was their previous record this year for TV. So it's like you're seeing small increases, and I would say like this was a show that, listen, years ago you go to the Now Arena, 5,000, you're not celebrating, but I do look at this as like a, you know, a achievement for the promotion of this beach break show over several weeks, and they drew 5,000 people for, and more importantly, coming out of it is you shot a really great angle for, you shot several big angles for Double or Nothing, and I would say the pay-per-view feels as though it's like, this does not feel like it's just your in between pay-per-view until you get to All In. It feels like it's a significant show on its own.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there you have it, everybody. Those are our thoughts on AEW Beach Break. We're going to say goodbye to everyone on the YouTube channel. If you're on the cafe, which all of you should be, where you get the XL edition of Rewind to Dynamite, Wayne and I did about 35 minutes off the top on all of the news items going on in the world of wrestling, plus a very analytical breakdown of the Leafs-Panthers series as they go into Game 6 on Friday night. But for all of you that want to jump onto the cafe, it is $6 a month that gives you access to all of our complete library of shows. We're going to be dropping Rewind Away on Thursday, covering the September 2003 episode of SmackDown, featuring the Iron Man match between Brock Lesnar and Kurt Angle, 1 week after Brock Lesnar took on Stephanie McMahon. So what a back-to-back week for Brock Lesnar. And we go into the real unfortunate tragedy in Kurt Angle's personal life going into this, where his sister died the night before this match took place of an overdose. So we go into all of that, hearing Kurt Angle's words himself as well, and all of the news and context of WWE at the time in 2003. It's quite the trip going back 22 years of WWE.
Yeah. I always marvel at like your level of research heading into these shows. John puts a lot of work into all of these, and you can listen to all 182 editions of Rewind Away if you sign up for just $6 at postwrestlingcafe.com.
Just put it on a loop.
That would probably take you like weeks to get through.
Yeah, we got time. Tell us what your feedback is at the end.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks to everybody. We're going to still go on the cafe, and goodbye to everyone on YouTube.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 16th through the 26th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your bedroom, living room, or home office, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL, and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.